from the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Georgia Public Broadcasting Studios in Macon, Georgia. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
The attack happened as Singh and a friend were walking along the Lenox Avenue.
He says the teens started yelling at him, calling him Osama and terrorist.
That there is a major problem in this country.
A couple of weeks ago, a Columbia University professor was brutally attacked and beaten on an upper Manhattan street. A practicing Sikh who was mistaken for Muslim because of his beard and his turban. Dr. Prajat Singh has made headlines since the attack with his message of love and service. A notable initiative from Stanford University's Peace Innovation Lab highlights the level of misinformation that contributes to this kind of violence and offers a roadmap for effecting change. I'll talk to lab co-director Margarita Kiwis.
The government shutdown will cost taxpayers $300 million a day.
We will do what we have to do to shut down the government.
$12.5 million an hour.
Life would go on without the federal government for a little while.
$1.6 billion a week.
Okay, government's going to have to shut down.
An even bigger crisis is creeping closer. On October 17th, the country will run out of money to pay its bills.
I say, shut it down.
After years of longing for a government shutdown on the part of some politicians and pundits, well documented in media appearances and campaign promises, they got their wish. Hundreds of thousands of government workers were told to stay home, and a broad range of services have been abruptly halted. You know, one thing that hasn't been talked about enough is the fact that the continuing resolution the House of Representatives repeatedly refused to vote on reflects a spending level that's remarkably close to the so-called Paul Ryan budget that caused such consternation not that long ago. As a reminder of the very real toll suspending social services is taking and the effects the stripped-down budget will have on the most vulnerable among us, you'll hear some excerpts from a conversation that I had with Sister Simone Campbell. We'll also tell you about a historic synagogue in the heart of Washington, D.C. that is hosting displaced government workers at their shutdown central. But first, particularly well-positioned to evaluate both the impact of what has been happening and of what is not happening is Simon Greer, president and CEO of the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Mr. Greer has worked as a labor and community organizer and social change leader for 20 years, and I am very pleased to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Simon, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
So has what's been going on this week in Washington surprised you or not?
I guess it hasn't really surprised me, but it has, in a lot of ways, broken my heart. Sort of in all three of my identities, as a dad, as an American, and as a person who takes my religious tradition seriously, I've never liked bullies. And it feels like this is just the next in a line of bullies who would jeopardize the lives of so many for what seem like really extreme ideological views from my point of view.
There are some people who identify the bullies as being different from the ones that we do. So will you talk about that? Because I think it needs to be talked about.
To me, our tradition's clear. Our God doesn't just call on us to love some of our neighbors, but to love them all. And I feel pretty strongly that our nation's values extend opportunity to all, not just to some. You know, I'm first generation in this country. I grew up seeing the benefits of rent-stabilized housing, of unemployment insurance, of affordable quality public higher education that my mom benefited from. And so my feeling is that those are the things that make America great, the things we do together. We volunteer together. We pay taxes together. We commit to each other, to the common good. And what I've seen kind of running roughshod over hundreds of years of that collective tradition so-called leaders like Senator Cruz, who for petulant reasons has brought our government to a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
I have a four-year-old, and when we play Candyland, you know the game Candyland?
Uh-huh.
When he thinks he's going to lose, he'll tip the board over. And for some reason, 30 million Americans getting health insurance feels like losing to Senator Cruz and some of his buddies, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're tipping the whole government over. And the problem is, you know, my son's four, and he's learning you can't do it. Here we have senators of the United States. We have elected leaders who are sort of playing the four-year-old, and they're not playing a game, right? They're playing with the lives and the livelihoods of literally millions of Americans.
What do you see as the most harmful effect of the government shutdown?
There's sort of the spiritual and the material.
Mm-hmm.
On the material level, this economy is fragile right now.
Yes.
We are not recovered, as everybody knows. And you take 800,000 people and you put them out of work, and you start to make reductions in the minimal SNAP benefits that we provide, in benefits to disabled military vets, to seniors, you could throw this economy back off a cliff. And so I think that is a very serious risk. And
mm-hmm.
the spiritual concern, you know, I actually heard Rabbi Sharon Brous, she talked about that, you know, many of us pray that tragedy or danger will pass over us, right? Not knock on our door,
mm-hmm.
but not enough of us pray or act on the concern that tragedy may strike at someone else's door. Let my children not be hurt by gun violence. Let my children not suffer through broken schools. But do I have approaching the same level of concern for someone else's child who may fall victim? And that's the spiritual crisis of our time. This is the expression of that. Right? It's the diminished concern or the lack of concern that the people who I'm not so affected, right? I still came to work today. Things seem to be functioning for me. But that sort of spiritual yearning to say, wait, this is a moral outrage. I will not let 800,000 people get furloughed. I can't stand by and let that happen. And I think this is maybe the most egregious expression we've had of that sort of, well, it doesn't hurt me directly, not my problem.
Are you satisfied with the way the faith communities are responding to this, or what would you urge the faith community to do more in terms of religious leaders?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think maybe it's just the personality problem. I don't think I'll ever be satisfied
mm-hmm.
on that front. When I saw Senator Cruz on the Senate floor comparing people allowing health insurance for 30 million to proceed and Chamberlain and the British, quote, accommodating the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
I didn't hear a massive faith outrage. And I thought, where are the literally thousands of people of goodwill, faithful people in this country who would say, you know, even if you don't like Obamacare, 30 million people getting health insurance and 6 million people getting sent to the gas chamber, there's nothing that links those two things, and there wasn't a moral outrage. So I definitely think we could do more. I was in synagogue on Yom Kippur, and I listened to the words of the prophet Isaiah talking about, you know, during our fast, God says, you know, is this the fast I desire, right, for you to be hungry, to look inside yourself. And yeah, I want that, but what I really want is to unlock the fetters of wickedness and untie the cords of the yoke,
yeah.
to let the oppressed go free, to break off every yoke, to share your bread with the hungry, and to take the wretched poor into your home. When you see the naked, to clothe him, and not to ignore your own kin. And then the presence of the Lord shall be your rear guard, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach. And I love it because it's our holiest moment of the year, and it doesn't say, you know, do a little bit of charity, or
mm-hmm.
stand a little courageous. This is a big, big ask. And so I feel like our work will never be done in that regard, and that in a moment like this, I would hope that all of us who see the dangers to our democracy, to our national soul, that we would sort of double down, we'd reach deeper and think, there is more I can do, whether it's more with my philanthropy, more with my time, more by reaching out to people who may have been seen as the other, more with my elected representatives, that there's just more there we can do. And I don't have judgment about how people do it, which sort of method they use, but
mm-hmm.
I think it is a moment to show our courage and our sort of collective resolve to come through this.
I fear that some of the people on Capitol Hill would listen to your profoundly prophetic words and say, oh, well, it's not fair to bring the Bible into this. And these are the same people who talk about religion on the campaign trail as if that's all they have is religion.
Yeah, you know, I obviously, as a religious minority, have huge respect for separation of church and state and think it's vitally important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go back and read the Gettysburg Address again and again, and Abraham Lincoln, he walked with some divine inspiration
yes.
on the journey he went on. And so, you know, I think it isn't that we should make our laws based on hubris, right,
mm-hmm.
to think that
mm-hmm.
I could understand what the divine calls for, and so we're going to legislate based on it. That seems beyond the pale to me, but it does feel like we all need some kind of a moral compass.
Absolutely.
And for people of faith, we find it in our faith traditions. And lo and behold, you have leaders who are doing these really draconian things. I mean, look at the pattern. In order to prevent Obamacare, or, you know, to try to prevent it from going into effect, we are going to shut the government down, which will cost the economy literally billions of dollars. We will continue to get paid, right, as members of Congress during that. And by the way, we're the same members of Congress who voted to eliminate SNAP benefits.
Mm-hmm. Right.
At some point, you have to say, you know, I've got to look my children in the eye and talk to them about the kind of country that we live in. What they're doing crosses my bottom lines about what it means to live a values-based life, to trust in something bigger than myself, and to believe that I'm going to leave this country better for my children than it was when I was born into it. And so I think at that point, people of faith have to have the courage to step into the public square and say our values do matter, and we will act on those values.
Simon Greer is president and CEO of the Nathan Cummings Foundation. He's the founder of Jews United for Justice, an urban social change group in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Tack it up, buddy, gonna shut you down.
Later in the show, a high-tech approach to reducing bias-based violence with Stanford University's Peace Innovation Lab. Right after completing last summer's headlines making Nuns on the Bus tour for Faith, Family, and Fairness, Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of NETWORK, a national Catholic social justice lobby, and I got together for a conversation about what was going on in the country. At that time, she was challenging the draconian budget cuts being promoted by Representative Paul Ryan and his supporters. Ironically, the continuing resolution that Congress has refused to vote on includes numbers very close to that Ryan budget. Between that and the social services crisis sparked by the government shutdown, this is a great time to revisit some of the enduring points that Sister Simone made at that time that are important for this time as well. I know that one of the focuses of the whole Nuns on the Bus tour was the so-called Paul Ryan budget. What do you think you were able to achieve in terms of that budget?
People didn't know what was in it.
Uh-huh.
People didn't know that the food stamp proposal that Mr. Ryan says, oh, churches can pick up this little cut, that it would require every church, synagogue, mosque, house of worship in the United States, every single one of us, to raise $50,000 each every year for 10 years to replace the money he's cutting from food stamps?
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Yeah.
And they also didn't know that the folks he's saying are taking advantage of the system are like the family I met at St. Benedict's Dining Room in Milwaukee, Billy and his wife and two kids. Whereas hours are cut back at work, they can only afford enough to either keep a roof over their head or food on the table. And to keep their kids in the same school, they chose keeping a roof over their head. And they go every evening to St. Benedict's for dinner. And then they use food stamps to do breakfast and lunch.
Mm.
I mean, this man is 133% of poverty. I mean, that's so low with a wife and two kids.
Yeah.
And what are they going to do?
Gosh.
What are they going to do?
I'm very interested in the faithfulbudget.org initiative.
Historically, many of the denominations have not had a policy around taxes and tax increases. But we all know in this economy we have to be responsible. We can't just continue putting good programs on credit cards. We should pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we also need to do the deep analysis of what got us into this problem, which wasn't social programs. What got us into this problem was at the time we decided as a nation to wage two wars, some of which we opposed, but we did make that choice to wage two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan rather than deciding to pay for them. At that very moment, we made huge tax cuts that benefited the wealthy principally.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what got us into this debt. So to be responsible and get us out of it, we know we've got to raise taxes and pay for what we put on the credit card.
Yeah.
That's what we have to do.
Which makes sense.
And so the faithful budget is a way forward of the Christians, Muslims, and Jewish community came together. We wrote it. We fought about it. We struggled, but we succeeded in writing a budget that says that we as a nation can be responsible. We can provide these programs for the most vulnerable, and that's who we are. That's what we should do. And there's other ways to save money going forward, as well as other ways to raise taxes.
For a listener to this program who says, I didn't get to see or meet the nuns on the bus, what should those listeners do to be involved?
It's very simple. You need to express to your neighbors. You need to express to your family. I need to express to folks like my brother Jim, who's kind of a contrarian whenever it comes to his older sister. But we need to talk to each other about who we are as a nation. And then we need to talk to our representatives in Congress that we believe that they should govern. They have to quit playing this political game where it's only about the sports metaphor, and they need to solve the tough problems of our times, not on the backs of people who are struggling to support this economy, not on the backs of Billy and his family, not on the backs of all the other folks that we saw that are struggling so hard. Rather, we need to be responsible as a nation, pay for our responsible programs with reasonable revenue. The fact is, we are not a nation based on individualism, and I'm calling that an unpatriotic lie. It is unpatriotic to try to say we all do it on our own. Rather, the clue is the first three words of the Constitution: we the people. That's who we are. We're a communitarian people. We're a communitarian nation. Democracy requires us to be in this together. We've got to have each other's backs. It's an article of faith in all faiths, but it's also a piece of our Constitution. That's what people need to do.
Sister Simone Campbell is the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. I'm grateful for your ministry. I'm grateful you were able to be with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Weldon. Together we can make the difference.
Up next, a hopeful new initiative from Stanford University that promises to leverage technology to combat religious bias-based violence in this country. And a snapshot of how one faith community in Washington, D.C. is giving furloughed federal workers a place to go with its Shutdown Central. After the bloodbath at the Oak Creek Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in the summer of 2012, hearings on Capitol Hill eventually led federal law enforcement agencies to begin tracking hate crimes against members of minority faiths. It's the first time they did that. Knowing the scope of the problem is an essential step, but it's not the only step. After that, we need to work toward a solution. More recently, the vicious attack on a Columbia University professor on a Manhattan street, mistaken for a Muslim because of his traditional Sikh garb, underscores the fact that this is an ongoing problem in our society. A hopeful initiative to challenge the root causes of this kind of violence has just been launched at Stanford University in cooperation with the Sikh American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and I am very happy to be joined by Peace Innovation Lab co-director Margarita Kiwis. Margarita, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Last month, you released a study titled Turban Myths. I think that's a good place to start. And so tell us something about that study.
What we did was basically do a broad literature review and seeing what had been written about Sikhs, because we wanted to take the conversation away from the anecdotal to really looking at data. And in the process of doing that, we uncovered a lot of interesting findings. The research included surveys that we did, in addition to wizard data on hate crimes against Sikhs, and then broadening it to looking at visual cues and bias. We looked at neuroscience, behavioral psychology studies, sociology studies, what had happened after 9/11. We also looked at studies that had been done looking at media, film, and video games, just to find out what's triggering this.
What do you think most Americans would find most surprising about the results you got?
Americans have a very flawed threat detection. We've been living in this era since 9/11 of saying we need to be hyper aware of terrorism as a threat to society. And so everyone has been conditioned in unconscious ways to scan for that. Americans make an association with a turban and a beard with terrorism. And so what happens is that citizens, individuals, we've all been subconsciously trained to have a particular bias, you know, because it's human nature to say, okay, evolutionarily speaking, we need to have good threat detection systems, right? Is that a lion? Is that a poisonous snake? Is this and that, right? So we're just wired for that. And we look at patterns that help reinforce that heuristic so we can create that rule of thumb, friend, foe, and so on. But in modern life, when we're living with such diverse groups of people, those ancient threat detection systems fail. And all of a sudden, we start perceiving people who are not threats as threats. When we looked at media, when we looked at film, Dr. Jack Shaheen had done an extensive study of how people from the Middle East were portrayed in film. And what you saw over and over again was this negative perception, these negative stereotypes. So he did an analysis of over 1,000 films that have Arab and Muslim characters from 1896 to 2000. In those 1,000 films, 12 had positive depictions, 52 were even-handed, and the rest of the 900 were negative. And so what happens in popular media and culture, we also see this in video games, is that people who have this physical look of an Arab or someone who of Islamic faith, and so you have the stereotypes of the robes and the beards and the turbans, they're labeled as the other and as the villain and as the bad guy.
How can the findings that you have in hand help start at least reducing religious-based violence?
I have a game designer in residence, and he and I started talking about this. And in game designs, they have a concept called a core loop. And the core loop is a sequence of steps that you want someone to take in order to complete some action. And so we started having this brainstorming around, what is the core loop of hate crimes? First, you started with the belief system. So the belief might be, oh, that guy in that headscarf looks like a terrorist that killed my friend in Afghanistan. So you have this core belief. And then there's going to be some sort of triggering event. There has to be an opportunity or a collision of events for a hate crime to occur. And so you might say, what is that suspicious-looking guy doing next to school? Or there might be a news event, and you might be, this person might say, I'm sick of these people, hurting, this community or my kids or being a threat. The next thing that occurs is that the perpetrator needs to feel that they have permission from the peer group or from authorities that they're doing the right thing. For instance, the FBI always says to warn authorities of suspicious packages, and I'm going to take care of this problem once and for all, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the action where the hate crime occurs. And then the next thing that needs to occur is the sense of lack of repercussion. So the perpetrator has to feel that there are going to be little or no consequences that they will bear because of their actions. And so they may have some false assumptions on the perpetrator's part, like, if I take this guy out, I'll be a hero for stopping a terrorist attack, right? That was really important to be able to unpack, to look at all those discrete steps, because once we have that framework, then we can start saying, well, what are the interventions that we can do prior to any of those steps? The study was done in collaboration with SALDEF, Stanford University, and Social by Design, which is a firm that looks at how to take some of the principles of behavior design and pro-social engagement and apply them in the world. And one of the programs that we're co-creating with them is this idea of peace by design. And so we take what we've learned in the university and say, oh, how can we design for peace?
Margarita Kiwi is the co-director of the Peace Innovation Lab at Stanford University and oversaw the recent Turban Myth Study. Margarita, it gives us hope that a really respected institution like you're in at Stanford is working on this important issue. And for now, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Rabbi Scott Perlow is Associate Director of Jewish Programming at 6th and I, a historic synagogue and community in Northwest Washington, D.C. The partial government shutdown that began last Tuesday has had far-reaching effects and generated plenty of headlines. But in keeping with a long-standing tradition of local outreach and service, 6th and I quietly opened its doors to furloughed federal workers, giving them a place to go in the fear and confusion of the deafening brinksmanship that has come to define our political process. Here to talk about that is Rabbi Scott. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend. It's a real pleasure.
Rabbi, how did the team at 6th and I decide to do this project?
It was spontaneous, and the truth is that we have been surprised at their response. Our director, Esther Fohr, who is an extraordinary person, just walked into the office and said, why don't we give people a place to go? And we sort of looked at each other and thought, it sounds like a great idea. We're blessed to have a team here with an extraordinary sense of humor, and I think humor is incredibly important in a situation like this where there's so much frustration and so much concern about what's going to happen. And so the team sort of got together. I have a picture on my office door that says Rabbi Scott Furlow instead of Rabbi Scott Perlow instead. And we've got some ping pong paddles with the faces of various politicians, you know, to relieve a little bit of the pressure.
You have a dartboard?
No dartboard yet, but along those lines. And it's been, I think, incredibly gratifying to see people respond, but incredibly surprising to see the attention that it's gotten.
Rabbi Perlow, what kind of folks have you met coming through your doors this past week?
So far, I've seen a number of middle-aged Russian-speaking women who we've never met before, some of our regular constituents, people who particularly enjoy the West Wing because we're streaming it 24 hours a day here. 6th and I has the benefit of not just being a synagogue but a cultural headquarters in Washington. We're very lucky because we have this beautiful space, and people often come to concerts and book talks and talks of general interest here. So we have seen really a wide range of people walk through the door, and as I mentioned, a surprising amount of media.
What kind of conversations have gone on?
What I'll say is that a number of the things that I've heard from the federal workers who are there is that they're actually reluctant to talk about the situation. They feel, if you don't mind me speculating, and this is certainly not what they've told me, but my speculation is that they feel divided loyalty. They're worried about their paycheck. And they're worried about what's going on in the government, but most of them are not political appointees. Most of them are the apparatus that keeps their country working and feel very strongly about the work that they do and feel warmly towards that work. And therefore, they're keeping quiet, I think, from what I understand, because they don't want to embarrass their particular institutions, no matter what they may feel about the shutdown. And that's the truth about Washington. You know, beyond the partisan politics, there are thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people who just work day in and day out to keep our country running. Those are the people who are being affected by the shutdown.
What about these people do most Americans not know and understand?
Sure.
Because when you know, and I know, because we're in Washington most of the time, that when you talk about Washington, people automatically think about political rancoring and all kinds of inflated rhetoric. I'm assuming that's not what you're hearing there.
I think you're 100% right, Reverend. You know, I'm from California, and when I thought I was moving to, you know, when I moved to Washington, I thought that, you know, the town, there was a bright red line in the middle of the town, and the Democrats lived on one side and Republicans lived on the other.
Yeah.
And that's not what Washington is. Washington is the machinery that makes our country work, and most of these people work, dedicate their lives and live in service to this country regardless of, or even sometimes even in spite of, their political opinions. And many of them in the State Department and in domestic kind of work and security work, they're just doing essential jobs, even if the government wants to call them non-essential. And I think what they're confused, understandably, about is that they're not in a political fight here. They're just trying to keep the country running, and they're trying to do their work. And all of a sudden, they are without a paycheck, and it's a very difficult thing to see.
What in the Jewish tradition spurs the creation of something like Shutdown Central?
I appreciate the opportunity. So in our shared tradition, people know the story of Abraham, who, according to the way that our Torah thinks about him, was the paragon of chesed, of kindness and love. And the way that he showed that was from sort of sitting outside of his own home, his own tent in the desert, waiting for passersby, in order to care for them, in order to offer them a place of respite and a place of rest. And in fact, that's how he met the three angels that told him about the birth of his son, and got into what is, you know, the most famous spiritual debate of all time with God about whether or not God should destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. With Abraham arguing for leniency and for mercy and for love. And the reason he did that is because he had his, as it were, home opened. And when we marry people in Judaism, we marry them under what's called a chuppah, a canopy. And that chuppah is open on all four sides, and it's supposed to symbolize the home. And the home is supposed to be open so that people who need it will have a place of respite there. And I know this is not unique to Judaism, but it is something incredibly important to us. In Hebrew, we call it hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. We believe that hospitality is a fundamental spiritual virtue.
Rabbi, this question is really about you and your colleagues that are doing the great work you're doing. How do you view the moral components of shutting down the federal government?
I thought that question might be coming. the problem is I speak as someone who is not who's not a political expert and who is in this really a regular citizen of this country. I just hope that the people who are involved in this debate and the people who are involved in shutting down the government understand the price that other people are paying for their brinksmanship. I really hope that it's at the forefront of their minds that what we're talking about is not a theoretical, is not rhetorical, is not something that is abstract or lived in the skies, but we're talking about people's jobs and their livelihood, and whether or not soldiers and other people who defend us and care for us are going to get paid. And I think that there are ways in which we sometimes make the idea of justice so big that we forget to see the idea of individual justice. And I'll quote for you the Torah, which I know you know as well, which is that one needs to pay a worker by the time that the sun goes down. People deserve the wage that they have earned, and to be able to put them out of work is an incredible cost, especially coming off of our economic disaster of the last year. I just really hope they understand what they're doing, and that they take it into consideration.
That's really well said. Wish I could tell you that all of the federal workers not at work today are listening to this show or will listen to it this weekend. That's not true, but I would like for you, if you would, to say an invitation for these people to come and drop by your place and tell them what would be good about that.
Sure. Thank you for giving me that great opportunity. We would love you to come from 10 to 4:30. Every weekday, you have a home here. Probably top on the list is that we've got free Wi-Fi for you. I have no illusions about what it is that people need. but an opportunity to blow off steam and frustration, to do outside work if you need to interact with other people who are in the same situation. A number of our people are coming forward to give talks, mini seminars, art classes, yoga classes, learning classes, Torah study, just random conversations of things that they are expert in as a way of making sure that they're able to use their skills even when their skills have been deemed non-essential for the moment. We think you're essential. Mm-hmm. We would love you to come by. Also, there's plenty of good food.
Rabbi Scott Perlow is Associate Director of Jewish Programming at 6th and I, a historic synagogue and community in Northwest Washington, D.C. They've opened their doors to furloughed federal workers with a space informally called Shutdown Central. Rabbi Scott, I really appreciate so much what you're doing for people in a tough situation, and also thank you for taking time away from that to talk with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Reverend, thank you, and God bless you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely, I promise you that, to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Please stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 800-856-0277. We encourage you, as always, to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen. Invite someone to listen for the first time and then debrief together. Before we go today, I also want to thank the good folks here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And I have to say something about just across the street, Mercer University, for I spent several good years there as senior minister to the university and also as a university professor. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.